and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast brought to you by Shooters in Nagoya. I'm John Gibson, and with me, as usual, is Jim Allen. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I had the sniffles, but I'm over them. I'm doing a lot better than some of our colleagues.
You get them, Mr. Calamity.
First thing I'd like to do is this week is give a shout-out to Jason Koskri of the Japan Times, a fine writer who is back home in the States right now dealing with some family matters. Good luck with that, Jason. I hope that all works out for you, buddy.
Hey, Jason. Take care.
And look forward to talking some NBA when you get back.
Yeah, because the conversation with Jim is a little short.
Short.
Huh? What?
Short. Unlike you. You yourself, what are you, 6'3"?
6'3".
You're a big dude, man. Got to get you on the court. This week we've got an interview with a former player, a guy who played back in the 70s, way back in the olden days.
former major leaguer with the White Sox, Royals, and Dodgers,
and
at least.
That's correct. And then we're going to discuss errors and hits and things that are going on at winter camp. So let's get started by clearing the bases.
All right. Last week, or 2 weeks ago, I guess, I had a chat with Dr. Gail Hopkins, who is now a retired orthopedic surgeon. Gail E. Hopkins, and he's a retired orthopedic surgeon in Parkersburg, West Virginia. And he is, according to baseball, I believe Baseball Reference, he may be the only former major leaguer with both an MD, although there are several of those, at least, and a PhD.
Wow.
And he's also a former member of the Hiroshima Carp and Nankai Hawks. He played 2 years with the Carp in 1975 and 1976.
Uh-huh.
And he came back unexpectedly for a final year with the Nankai Hawks. And we had a chat about a wide range of topics.
You think? Over about 3.5 hours?
Yeah, it was pretty educational. It was pretty educational, so I enjoyed it immensely. And I gather that he did it as well. He remembered a lot of his Japanese. And anyway, it was good fun. And he gave us a lot of insights into the way the Carp were that year. And, of course, his first year, 1975, was kind of a magical one for the Hiroshima Carp. It was their first ever championship of anything. They won the Central League and they won the Japan Series, and right. Hopkins hit the home run that clinched the Central League pennant. And he had a big season, came back for another one in which he was competing for the batting title. and thus starts the story.
Yeah, now first let me say this is a fabulous interview, Jim. You did a great job. And I say that laughing because Jim came in the office and he said he asked one question and he didn't speak for 4 hours.
I was exaggerating slightly.
Slightly. Well, Jim did enough speaking and the interview was actually, the file he gave me was only 3 hours and 20 minutes. So.
Oh, yeah, I thought it was longer.
Oh, no, it was only 3 hours and 20 minutes. And I know this because I listened while I was out doing a long run. The other day in preparation for another marathon, dumb, stupid me. But, I wish you all could hear the entire interview, and I know you're working on a project, and this is going to be part of the project, but I really immensely enjoyed the interview.
Yeah, well,
it was fantastic.
When I told my wife some of the stories in there, she said, you got to write a book about this guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's, I'm thinking about that. Actually, I don't know how that's going to work, but there are enough stories in there to start several projects, so I'm working on that.
Right. And I was listening as I was running through the streets of Greater Tokyo thinking, man, what a great time this must have been back in the 70s to be in Japan. It's just such a different world now, and as I'm, dodging Prius, hybrid cars and and then seeing a woman still using a broom that looks like something out of the Flintstones to what a world, what a place this is that we live in. It's awesome.
It's quite amazing. And so many things. from the first question they asked him in Japan.
right.
So anyway, he after winning the winning the pennant with the Carp the first year, he came back and the Carp really struggled. And nobody was hitting, and he had changed his stance so that he had basically learned to hit home runs as I think a 33-year-old. And in his first season, because they needed somebody with power, and he just applied a lot of it.
Instead of learn to say hit home runs, I prefer to say change his approach to trying to drive the ball a bit
more.
Yeah,
there were some issues there, and the key one there was don't worry about strikeouts, which is something that he said he always worried about strikeouts, and he said, you know, he was kicking himself. He said, you know, I should have learned this lesson a long time before I turned 33. Anyway, he had a great season. He hit a bunch of home runs. The Carp win the pennant. The next year, everything's falling apart. And he goes back to his then what happens is he starts the season the same way, and they say, you're not hitting for average. But I don't know what it was, May or something, and they said, you're hitting 250. What's wrong? You're trying to hit too many home runs. And so he went back to his batting approach that he'd had for 90%, 95% of his major league career, which was to drive the ball up the middle, go to the gaps, hit line drives. And he hit for a high average. He was a big high on-base percentage guy. He always, in fact, he said that 1975, and I checked this, and he was astounded by how many strikeouts he had. He couldn't believe he struck out 53 times.
Only 53. Take that, today's major league guys.
And this was a guy who was striking out, he thought, left, right, and center.
Yeah.
It was the first time in his career he had ever had fewer strikeouts than more strikeouts than walks.
So essentially, they asked him to hit for power, and then I'm sorry, they asked him to hit for average, or they didn't ask him anything. He was just
hitting
for average.
Well, the first year was
and they wanted him to.
He had an American manager,
okay.
And the American manager said, "I need to hit home runs because that's what we don't have," and so he did. And then he just kept hitting that way. Although the American manager lasted until, I don't think he lasted to the beginning of May. I think he was fired very early in the season.
Okay. So they wanted him to hit for more average, and so he went back from trying to drive the ball.
Yeah, he went back to his old style, and he's hitting the ball a ton. He stopped hitting home runs, and then sometime towards the end of the season, they said, "Hey, your average is very high, but you're not hitting home runs."
Right.
So anyway, at this point, he starts to put two and two together, and it seemed like the team was telling him not to hit for average. And at the same time, he's leading the batting race, the Central League batting race, by a mile over a trio of guys, Kenichi Yazawa, who is the fellow who turned me on to Mr. Hopkins, and Isao Harimoto of the Giants then, and one other fellow who was Tsutomu Wakamatsu of the Swallows, who he had a great admiration for all three of these fellows. Anyway, they were way behind him in the batting race after they'd all had close to 400 at-bats, he said, when suddenly things started to turn and these guys started to zoom up the leaderboard, zoom up toward, close in on his averages. His average was sinking. They were climbing, you know, at record rate. You know, they had the afterburners on, everything was a hit. And he shed a little light on his perspective on exactly why that happened.
Okay, so we're going to actually pick the interview up, of course, in the middle of the story. And this is a 1976 batting race. And he kind of shed some light onto what probably still plays a significant role, or a slight role. We're not sure how much of a role, but it plays a role, possibly.
A good story, anyway.
It plays a role, possibly, in why the scoring decisions are so iffy.
Interesting.
Creative,
imaginative. Yeah.
All right, let's take a listen to the interview.
When we got into that 76 season, I thought, you have to go back and you can look at it, but there were a few of us, and you might look up who the guys were.
Right.
Izawa and some others. We were, we got to somewhere around in June, July.
Okay.
I was at 400. I was over 400. And the nearest to me, there were a few guys hitting in the low 300s.
Right.
And we got to,
Oh, that's right.
as, And then all of a sudden, there's this, which was kind of new to me. There was this dialogue that was going on in the newspapers, and
okay.
and Kanemoto would read it to me. And it sort of went along the lines of saying the Japanese, they were no, I mean, an American at that point had never led the league in hitting.
Okay.
And led the Central League.
Right, right.
Not the Pacific, the Central. And, you know, the truth is at that point, the Central League was sort of the Emperor's League.
Sure, sure, sure.
Stuff. And so, they decided, they weren't getting me out, so they decided that they would, the pitchers in the league, and right. I can't remember who it was, said that the pitchers in the league have the right to decide who is the batting champion.
Ah.
And so I started walking. They were going to walk me into a slump.
Okay.
And so, you know, there was a streak there where I would walk three times
yeah.
in a game or four times in a game.
Wow.
And it was real interesting. We played the Giants up in Sapporo, and I don't know how many times I walked,
huh.
but I didn't get to, you know, the point was that as, it became really a big deal. And then there were other players whose all of a sudden their batting averages started going up and they started coming up pretty yeah. quickly. Now you're already into the season with 300 or 400 at bats.
Right.
You know, and these guys were coming up pretty fast. I really have to apologize right now. The guy from, Tayo, the Whales, the small left-hand hitter. He was with one of the Tokyo teams.
Oh, I know who you're talking about. The small guy. Wakamatsu.
Yes.
The outfielder.
Wakamatsu could hit the ball.
Yeah,
that guy, and he had a really good, I mean, he hit the ball hard. He was quick. And, these guys all of a sudden just started coming up, and I tried to explain to some of the reporters who were asking me about winning the batting title. I told them, and it was absolutely true, it doesn't really matter to me.
Okay.
And I said, actually, and I told them, of the people who are in the batting title race,
right.
I think I'd like to see Wakamatsu get it.
Okay.
Because he's had a good career, right. but I don't think he's gotten the notoriety he
right,
needs.
Right.
Or that he needs, or justified.
Right, right.
But we played, but it was the culture. That was a big cultural lesson for me.
Ah.
Now Japanese won't like this, but when that happened, when all these guys all of a sudden started coming up, their batting averages
right.
was coming up. I was hitting about 350 then,
okay.
and some of them were hitting. Had come up to the 330s,
right.
or in that range, and we played in Hiroshima, and Wakamatsu hit a ball to Mimura in
uh-huh.
a day game, and Mimura, the ball goes right through Mimura's legs,
right,
straight ground ball to Mimura, goes right through his legs. That one scored a base hit.
Okay.
Then Wakamatsu hits a ground ball to me at first base the next time, and I kicked it. It wasn't a hard play. The ball was at me, and I didn't play the ball right. I kicked it, and he got on. That was a base hit. and in fact, I walked over to first base, and I looked up at the, and they flashed
right.
hit the H, on the
yeah.
scoreboard. And it was so bad that the players in our dugout and in their dugout were laughing.
I've seen that. I've seen it.
They were laughing, you know, and so I walked over to Wakamatsu at first.
Right.
And I liked him. So, you know, I walk over and I stand on first and I popped him on the leg with my glove and said, "Hey, nice batting, man." And the poor guy just wouldn't look up.
Well, he doesn't talk much anyway. He doesn't say too much.
But the guy was a good ball player.
He's oh good, yeah.
And well, the next day we played. That was, you're right. It was the Tayo Whales, because The next day we played the Tyo Whales and Cleet Boyer.
Right, right.
And we were all sitting in the dugout and talking about different things.
Right.
And laughing about, you know, we were just shooting the breeze about everything. And the scorekeeper,
right,
the guy that was the scorekeeper, somehow walks through the dugout. And I saw him, and I said, "Hey, Chota Mate." And I said, I asked him, I said, "How?" And I really was kind of interested in this. I said, "How can you score those two errors yesterday as base hits?" And he said, no, those are hits." And I said, no, those were errors." And so, and there's an interpreter there too,
right,
with us. My interpreter,
right,
was there. And I said, "Look," I said, "the ball goes through his leg. That ground ball to me is an error, even in the Little League.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt." And he said, you scored him a hit." And he says, no. I said, so I walked up to him and I touched him on the chest and I go like this with my finger and I say, "You know, in your heart that those were errors. And that all the people who have watched baseball in Japan all these years, and all the people in the future who will read about baseball, you have cheated them, and you know in your heart those were errors, that the game is not honest. And when you do that, and you cheated all those people, even the players in the dugouts were laughing, you know." And I told him, "You know, the players were not laughing at Wakamatsu; they were laughing at you." And this guy just threw a fury. I mean, he said, and then he walked off.
Okay.
Well, Clayton the four of us just sat there and talked for a while, and then we had to go get ready to play,
right,
you know. And so, and I went upstairs and started reading,
right,
like I usually do. Okay, I went up to the place where I read books in the cafe, and I went up there to read.
Was this in Hiroshima? Time.
Yeah, it was in
Hiroshima.
Wow. Right.
The bottom, so I can't imagine any place where you have enough room to even like stretch your elbows in that park.
Well, no, they have a dining room up there for the newspaper guys and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And so I would go up there and have coffee and read my book because I could sit on a table.
Okay.
And so I went up there and I was reading and I came down to get ready, you know, 15 minutes before the game to get ready to play. And I walk in. It turns out there was a fight. There was a big problem. My interpreter, everybody's still trying to calm my interpreter down.
Oh,
it turns out that the scorekeeper came back to our dugout later on looking for me.
Oh.
And so he's looking for me to justify what he did. And Sam, my interpreter, Takahashi was his name. They call him Isamu, but we call him Sam.
Right.
And Sam got so upset because the guy there in the dugout with the other Japanese players around was trying to justify that they were hits.
Right.
And even the Japanese, my players laughed and they said, "No, they weren't hits, you know, but they're scoring hits." And the guy finally screamed at Sam. He says, "Well, are you Japanese?"
Whoa.
That's right.
Fighting words.
He asked Sam. And Sam says, "Gail-san," he asked me if I was Japanese. And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, if you're Japanese, then you know why there were scored hits." And they got into a fist fight.
I've never heard anything like that.
They got into a fight, and the players had to separate them.
Wow.
In the dugout. And so, you know, but the point, I guess one of the things that, and it honestly didn't bother me, because at that point, you know, it's not my country.
Right.
I love it. I could live there. I mean, the people, the place, the culture. I mean, I loved all that, and still do. But nobody in Chicago ever heard of the Central League. If I led that league in hitting, what did that matter?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and I think was it Yazawa?
Yazawa won. Yazawa won.
He won it that year. Yeah, he ended up being the one. There was somebody else that came up with Wakamatsu, Yazawa.
Harimoto.
Yeah. That's right.
The Korean guy with the Giants, who wasn't supposed to be known as Korean, except he kept telling people he was Korean.
Oh yeah, no, he was a real character. Yeah, I Hiramoto was a good competitor.
Yeah,
it's a lot of things, but that guy could hit the ball.
Oh yeah, he's the other one with 3,000 hits in Japan.
Yeah, he could hit the ball. I mean, he was a good hitter. Yeah. But you know, all of those cultural differences, those kind of things like that, I think had a lot to do with why a lot of Americans who go over to play. Just don't do well. Right. I mean, if, you know, the guy calls a strike on you or you hit a ground ball and it is a base hit and they call it an error or something like that, you know, that after a while, wears on a lot of people.
Sure.
And, you know, I didn't like it.
Sure.
I mean, don't get me wrong, but there's some things you can do things about and some things you can't.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'd like to say one thing, it's two things Mr. Hopkins and I have in common.
Which are
both of us use our middle names, which start with Ishii.
So what, should I start calling you John Eason Gibson?
Well, they start with E.
Okay.
His is Eason, mine is Emil, as we all know. And the second thing is that we were both involved heavily with the Dodgers.
Hold on. The Dodgers. He was getting paid by the Dodgers. He played in a World Series.
I was living and breathing and would be sick when they lost and happy when they ate. I would think I was very.
Are you sure, John? Are you sure that wasn't the smog?
I mean, in Southern California in 76 when there was no gas, when the gas crisis was hitting.
I was 78, youngster.
Well, somewhere around there when my mom was driving a Pinto, then we didn't have, yes,
my every
thought was about the Dodgers, so I was heavily involved. Now, whether it was professionally or not, that doesn't matter. We were involved. In fact, I have a story for you. I lost my marbles.
No argument there, man.
Back in 76. Because this was the last time I ever bet on sports. Way back in 76, I was a pretty good marble player. And I bet my entire collection that the Dodgers would win, and they lost. It wasn't 76, it was 73. And they lost. And I think Mr. Hopkins showed up the year after.
He was there for 74.
In 74, exactly. Well, no, I don't think they won the World Series that year, but I was, Mr.
So
I
they
just,
lost to the A's. They yeah. played the
Yeah, I just know that Mr. Hopkins had nothing to do with me losing my marbles, which is good. But yes, we were both heavily involved with the Dodgers. But I found this very enlightening and very engaging. He's a really good storyteller and a good speaker, sort of like you.
Right. Yep, that's me. So, yeah. So, what do you think about? Well, this whole thing was it was both shocking and. Suspect, you know, something that was not that shocking. I mean, if you lived in Japan, you see things every day you never thought you'd ever see, and then you realize, well, I'm kind of surprised I never saw it before.
Well, yeah, I mean, when I heard this story, it really kind of opened the door, because I had been wanting to talk about errors and scoring decisions for a long time and just basically ran about the scorekeepers. And now I hear this story, and it just made me open my eyes a little bit more, because you know that some of these things go on. For example, who's pitching, who's batting,
sure.
who's the fielder, what's the situation in the game? Can guys get away with making a call, a hit or an error? How's it going to affect anything? And safe to say that newspapers were the you know, maybe they had some of these magazines, you know, the weekly magazines he spoke of in the interview that we didn't play.
Yeah.
But, you know, there were methods of getting the word out, but it was always later, after the fact. Now we have so much television, so many reporters, the internet, YouTube, Twitter. If you make a poor call, a poor judgment call, people are going to complain about it, and people are going to know about it instantly. And you couldn't get away with some of the things probably in 76 that you could get away with. So I think it's a much different world we live in.
One wonders. I mean, we had a case, I'm going to say Hirosawa, Katsumi Hirosawa is still playing for the Giants, and this is a
I'm going to say he joined the Giants, I'm going to say maybe 1999 or so, and he there was a game against the Tigers, and the umpire first blew a call so badly, he tagged a guy out, and the umpire just missed it. I mean, he blew it so badly, it was obvious to people, you know, watching the game from Jingu Stadium, you know, 2 miles away.
Yeah.
Anyway, and it's like, it was obviously he missed it. Okay, now either the same game or the next day, I think more likely the next day, I'm trying to remember how this happened, but there was a play at the plate in which Hirosawa was scoring, and he was coming down the line, and the guy tagged him, and it was obvious that they tagged him.
Mm-hmm.
Or I take that, I'm trying to recall this. Okay, Hirosawa made a throw, and there was a Tigers runner trying to score, and the runner beat the throw by a good margin. The tag was wide. It wasn't close. The umpire just rang the guy out. And it was like Hirosawa stood there in left field laughing. He couldn't control it. He had his glove pressed against his face so people couldn't see him laughing, but he was almost doubled over.
Right. Well, so, yeah, I mean, you know, it happens now, but I mean, you know, it really frustrated me. It has really frustrated me since I got this job, since, you know, 2005.
Right.
Watching some of the scoring decisions that go down, but you know, when you got gold glove guys out there, who have the reputation, you know, they sometimes get the benefit of the doubt. When you have pitchers on the mound whose ERAs are going to be affected,
right,
they sometimes get the benefit of the doubt. When you have hitters chasing goals,
right,
top front-line hitters,
yep,
it's going to change, you know, the opinion of the quote-unquote official,
right,
scorer, when it shouldn't.
Well, you know, in my mind, it's only quantitatively different from the errors that one will see in the ninth inning of a game in which there's been no hits.
Right, yes.
You know, a ball that would have been an error in the first inning, a ball that would have been a hit in the first inning is now an error. You can't miss a play. Any ball that gets through, and the guy is, if the fielder is within spitting distance of the ball, it's going to be an error because they want the guy to have a no-hitter.
Yeah.
We've seen it dozens of times. In Japan, this is something that happens a lot more. Now, the question you have to always ask, and I know Whitey Herzog, the former Hall of Fame manager of the Texas Rangers, Kansas City Royals, and St. Louis Cardinals, and former general manager of the Cardinals and the Angels, will get all of Whitey's illustrious career in there.
Just his resume, why don't you? Go ahead.
I would if he was paying me. Okay, anyway, Whitey was saying that basically umpires take the path of least resistance. And this is not a new story. This is why there are more blown calls. When there's a blown call at second base on a stolen base, it always goes the way of the fielders because the runner is there by himself and you're surrounded by the pitcher, the second baseman, and the shortstop. Okay,
right.
So,
yes,
so it's the easy way out.
Yeah.
And what I think in Japan, so often giving somebody a hit when an obvious error is made, especially when both players are Japanese, is the easy way out.
Yeah. Well, you know, the one thing that you and I were talking about the other day, I think when we were taking a coffee break, was the fact that they call plays on fielders when they misplay a ball, but they don't give a glove, they don't get a glove on it, but it is a routine play. It would have normally have been a routine play had they not misplayed it. But they don't get charged with with an error on those plays. It goes as a hit toward the pitcher.
Very often, yeah,
and,
typically.
And
everybody
and
gets credit except the pitcher.
Because he didn't get a glove on it. I'm like, well, the error came before that. How could he get a glove on it? He'd already butchered the play.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. Those should be errors. But those are another more judgment calls that we're going to put in the hands of these so-called scorers, official scorers.
Well, these scorers, unlike in major leagues where the scorers are writers,
yes,
the Japanese scorers, we have to be specific here, because there actually is a job in Japan for people who are known as scorers, and they are not scorers, they are scouts.
Yes.
They are advanced scouts are known as scorers.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, the official scorers are fellows who work for the league offices. They're just people who work in the office at the league office doing one job or another, and when they need them, they assign them as official scorers.
Right.
Okay. Now, I did a study once and found out essentially that sometimes the sabermetric formulas for predicting runs don't work quite as well in Japan. And the reason I think they don't work quite as well in Japan is because you have more hits in Japan.
Uh-huh.
Relative to, there are fewer errors made in Japan. It doesn't mean the Japanese fielders are better or the conditions are any better. It means that people give out fewer errors.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, so my first inclination with this was something that happens less and less. You see more errors on plays in the outfield. It's very common in the majors. You get a single and an error. This used to never happen in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Now it happens fairly often. My first realization of this was a Seibu Lions Oryx Blue Wave game sometime in the 90s. A single up the middle, charged by the center fielder, goes through under the center fielder's glove, rolls all the way to the wall,
mm-hmm.
and it is scored. A triple.
That's
because Satoshi Takahashi failed to pick up a ground ball.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, all I can say is when you guys see a weird call this season, you know, take a look and see who the batter is, take a look and see who the pitcher is. Look at the game situation. I mean, you know, you got guys, big name guys up there like Ichiro or Hideki Matsui. You're gonna usually end up with hits a lot of times rather than errors.
That's off the glove. Oh, yeah. And if the fielder's a foreigner, then the error doesn't hurt as much.
Yeah.
And if it's a batter and a fielder are both foreigners, it hurts even less.
Ouch.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is happening.
All right. Well,
it does happen sometimes on some occasions. Okay.
All right. All right, well, thanks for that interview. We really appreciate it, and please give our best to Mr. Hopkins and tell him thank you very much. Cool. All right, let's talk about camps real quick. There are three new skippers in the Central League, one in the Pacific League. Have you been able to pay attention to anything that's been going on at camp? And I know the answer to this question before I even ask it, but, you know, you got
to
go through
pay attention to things that are going on in camp. you mean other than looking at the calendar and thinking, what days would I like to go if I want to use my frequent flyer miles?
No, Jim, nobody cares about your frequent flyer miles, dude.
Good.
No, but I thought it was really, really humorous that our Yokohama DeNA Bay Stars, whatever you want to call them, their skipper, the second day of camp is out with the flu.
And then followed
soon after by the veteran guy who probably doesn't want to be at camp this early anyway, Mr. Ramirez, Mr. Alex Ramirez.
Alex showed up, and Ronnie Chun showed up, which is, I think Cabrera's even showed up. This might be a record for him. It's not even the 15th of February, and he's already in camp.
Well, I think, you know, he's dusting off the you know, uniform, because he didn't play that much last year. He figures he might as well get in early and start his work early. Maybe he'll even get warmer earlier.
Well, I think
even if the weather doesn't.
I should pick on Alex. Anyway, so yeah, they had the cold is an issue, and everything's an issue about Japanese spring training. Anything interesting? I don't know. It's hard to say since I haven't been there to walk, look, and see. We do have the four new managers. And much of the news was Nakahata's influenza.
Not influencing on the team or on anything. He's just, you know what he is? I mean, because I've watched the news a couple of times, and they said, you know, usually at a Yokohama camp there might be 40 to 50 reporters. Now there's more than 100.
Right.
And they're all there to to listen to his babble and to, you know, be entertained by him. And they, they talk about how charismatic he is and everything. What about the team? Let's get into the players, people. I mean, you know, let's get to the meat and potatoes and not look at the clown and point at the clown and laugh there. Let's look at the
clown.
Team.
Clown? Come on.
And I didn't say he's a clown in, you know, per se. He's just playing the role. He's playing the role of clown.
This is the gentleman who was known lovingly by Tigers fans as Bakahata.
Bakahata, yeah, well.
And he was, that was his persona. And to be honest, he was that kind of a lovable lunk when he was a player, and he's doing the same as a man, just the kind of guy you want as a manager.
Yeah, well,
anyway.
Good luck with that. Hopefully, I think I saw a picture of Ramirez. I don't know if that meant that he was back at practice and back on the field or not, but let's assume he is, and he's got to stay healthy for them. But, I saw Nakahata, I saw Wada talking. He's got his pitchers doing things differently, and he's got some of his position players out there on the mound. I think he put some of his position players out there on the mound just to see what it was like, and he wanted them to experience what it was like to be the pitcher and have all the pressure on him. And he's doing some things that are different. I like that, but
I do too.
I don't know how much that's going to help.
It is important to do things differently, especially when you have free reign and you got license to get you can get away with anything when you're new.
Yeah. Now, one thing I haven't seen the Dragons skipper, which is probably good. I've seen more about the players than I have about the skipper.
You see the players now, which is new, because used to be the Dragons. The good thing about the Dragons camp is I've probably bored everyone to tears, is that it used to be nonstop, very focused, very intense and energetic, and it looks like it's now devolved into your standard Japanese camp, which is don't get hurt, don't move too fast, throw out your arm. Oh, speaking of which, we had an arm story. Who was it who was throwing? Oh, Utsumi. Today the news, tomorrow's news, I shouldn't say that. Tomorrow's news will be how Utsumi has thrown his second tough Nagekomi session of the spring in a row.
Nice. All right, well.
And I'll remind you that a Nikon sports story that was saying why Valentine was fired and why in 2010 and 2009 and why the Marines were so much better without him said that Nagekomi made the difference when the Marines' pitching got worse, and the guy they used as an example for the person who threw the most pitches threw out his arm in April and never came back.
Mm-hmm.
And last year's deterioration of the Marines pitching staff under the regime continued.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, there's that. Okay,
yeah,
so,
well, we won't bring that up. That's probably what they used to decide the MVP of the Pacific League. No, I blame everything on those people.
Could be.
Now, the thing I did notice about the Dragons, though, was that the new skipper, who is an old skipper and a former skipper at the same time, has switched Ibata and Araki back to their original positions. So Ibata will be at short and Araki will be at second this year. So we'll see how that works out for them. But the thing I didn't like was the things I'm seeing from the Nippon Ham camp, which is I'm not sure their manager, right. Mr. Kuriyama. I'm not sure I just didn't like his demeanor. Let's put it that way. He seems to be more like a fan of his team than the skipper of his team.
He's a TV sportscaster.
Yes. Yeah. He doesn't come across as a skipper type. He comes across as...
He's a very friendly sportscaster. He's not one of these tough, you know, critical guys.
Yeah. And I think they're, you know, I don't know. I'm going to hopefully talk to one of the pitchers this week and do a story. But, you know, it looks like they're going to... Masaru Takeda is going to be the number one guy.
Okay.
And then after that, it looks like Yuki Saito is going to be their number two. I hope not. But it looks like... They're heading in that direction, so I don't like what I'm seeing up there. And stuff.
I expect Yuki Saito to get better, if only for the reason that now he's got good coaching and he's got people looking after his physical conditioning and he's a more convincing, he went to university and the first year it was a blast and he was ultra competitive and then, as soon as he won the MVP of the Tokyo Six Universities League, he just kind of sat in his butt for 3 years.
Well, I agree with you. I think he's going to be better.
And so he's, I think now he's in a situation where he's got to compete again, and I think that's what he wanted, and he's getting it. So I think he'll be better. And he might be a number two starter. I don't think anybody sees that right now. He doesn't have the zip on his fastball, and but he's got, he's pretty fearless.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to throw his pitches, and he doesn't throw hard, and he really never has blown people away, I don't think so. He's going to use a lot of pitches. I think he's going to use a lot of pitches. I wouldn't be surprised if he tries to throw six or seven or even eight pitches when he's out there and try to trick guys. One thing they did show that on the news is that he's a really clutch pitcher, if you can say that, that his batting average against with runners in scoring position was something like fifth best in the Pacific League. It was like 182 or something like that. So.
Well, he certainly had a lot of practice doing it.
Yeah, this was one of his hobbies, was to put guys on base.
Yeah, that's sort of like, lure him into a false sense of security.
Well, he's pitching around people, we know that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's that strategy in Japan that, you should walk certain. Actually, that's the Leo Mazzoni strategy, to be honest, is don't worry about walks per se, just worry about specific individual ones. Okay.
All right, well, let's worry about specific questions to deal with, and we're going to start with fielding questions. All right, the first one is from Dave, and Dave says, hopefully no one has already bugged you about this, but I wanted to point out something about a comment you guys made on the last show. I think it was me who made the comment. You said that there are only three foreign-born players in the Japanese Hall of Fame, and they were Victor Sarafin, Wally Yonamine, and Saruhara Oh. And I realize you're including Oh despite his being born in Tokyo because his father was Chinese and he holds a Taiwanese passport, but if that's the criteria, shouldn't Isao Harimoto be included in the list? And then Dave goes on to explain some other guys who we call Zainichi, Korean, who people were born and raised in Japan but do not hold Japanese passports. So, our crack staff, John, called the museum
and spoke to the Hall of Fame Museum.
The Hall of Fame Museum spoke to a very nice gentleman who answered the phone and promptly said, if I can't answer your question, this isn't the library.
Okay.
This wouldn't be the library at the Hall of Fame.
Good answer.
He was very confident. So I said, okay, please give me the number of non-Japanese nationals who were players,
right,
who are in the Hall of Fame here in Japan.
Okay, so people are in Hall of Fame as players.
As players. So he called back after an hour and he said, well, I can't answer your question.
Right. So what did you say? This is it, that you aren't the library.
You are not the library. He said the reason is because they don't ask that question.
Sure.
They don't require, there's nothing on their forms that says, nationality.
Right.
Therefore, they can't tell us the exact number. And he wouldn't even give me a number. Right. And so, yes, there are Japan-born and raised foreign passport-holding players who look Japanese, speak Japanese, and foreigners have a tough time telling that they're not Japanese, and there are X number of them in the Hall of Fame.
They're culturally Japanese because they grew up here, but not.
And ethnically, yes.
And there is the one example of the foreign-born Hall of Famer who is Japanese, who is Tadashi Wakabayashi,
mm-hmm.
who was born in Hawaii, and I believe he went to high school in Honolulu. But he was a Japanese citizen and played professional baseball in Japan. So, as far as I know, other than him, the only foreign-born foreign player
mm-hmm.
In the Hall of Fame is Wally Yonamine.
Yeah.
Oh, I will exclude Starfish because he grew up in Japan.
He was born overseas, but he spent most of his life.
He was an ace pitcher for Asahikawa, one of high school in Asahikawa. So. in Hokkaido. So he was a big amateur baseball star in Japan. So I think we have to consider him in the same group with O and Harimoto and them.
Will do. All right, let's. You know, I'm gonna maybe ask Simon to get us a new sound for the MP3 questions, because this is the first ever MP3 question that we received for the podcast. And this,
excellent.
Here it is.
Hi, this is Dennis from Kobe. What do you project to be the numbers for Yu Darvish and Hisashi Iwakuma over in the major leagues this season? And what do you think will be the largest obstacle for each one to overcome? And who is going to fill the void in Japan and emerge as the star pitcher and future major leaguer? Love the show. Thanks.
Okay, well, projections and obstacles. Projections, first of all, for Iwakuma and Darvish.
Iwakuma, who knows? I mean, my projection, honestly, my projection for Iwakuma is that he'll start about 12 games. And be range from being deadly effective to what's this guy doing in our uniform? And
I'm
so
feeling the love here.
Yeah,
I'm sensing a lot of.
He's got a lot of tools, and he's a competitor, but his biggest issue is his injuries and his ability to pitch on a regular in a rotation, in a major league rotation. He had enough trouble pitching in a Japanese rotation and staying healthy.
Yeah,
he's broken down essentially once every 3 years, which is typical of players who had abused arms as youngsters.
Yeah, I'm thinking it's very difficult to project him because of his team's offense. I could see him losing a lot of games consecutively because he might pitch well. Let's say pitching well for him might be an ERA of about 3.5. Let's say somewhere around there.
Or lower.
Even lower. But this team that he's going to, I mean, I looked up on ESPN stats, and right. The stat category that I looked up, there were 12 categories.
Right.
The Seattle Mariners finished last in 8 of the 12 categories, and they were near the bottom in the other 4. Okay,
well,
out of the 30 teams.
They're not going to be a big run-scoring team. They're not going to be they're never going to lead. No team playing in Safeco Field is ever going to lead the American League in runs scored, regardless of who's in your lineup.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that it's mostly a Safeco Field thing problem, but we'll have to see.
It
is a good pitcher's part, and then that's part of the equation, and I understand that. And they're going to be different. They're probably going to be a little bit better. I wouldn't say that they won't be worse, because even though they were last in runs, they were last in runs, hits, total bases, average, on-base percentage, slugging, OPS, and anything else you want to throw in there, they were near the bottom. They were.
And the silver lining and all that is?
That he's going to be pitching in a pitcher's park.
Right, exactly.
He'll keep games close. And
okay, he'll have a low ERA, and he'll have a great – he'll be doing a the likely scenario, in other words, is the ultimate scenario, the ultimate nightmare for Iwakuma is a 2011 Hiroki Kuroda season, which he has his career year, and nobody knows it because nobody scores when he pitches.
Yeah, unfortunate. So, I mean, win-loss, I have no predictions. I'll give you a number because I would like to see the Mariners win when he's on the mound at least 8 times. So I'll go 7 to 8 wins, but I can go just as many losses. And I think that is the big obstacle for him, is he's got to be tougher physically. He gets injured. I heard from a little bird that he's not the most he's not the toughest guy. I mean, he's kind of a wimp. And the injuries that he gets that shouldn't keep him off the mound, keep him off the mound. So when Jim says 12 starts, did you say? I'll give him more than that, but not too many more, if he's, his normal self. If he's injured and has a legitimate injury, yeah, he could miss a lot of starts. So, let's go to Darvish now. What do you want to project on Darvish?
Well, Darvish.
Do you want to bring up this article that we ran in the Yomiuri Shimbun, which was an excellent piece, I thought. I couldn't say it with a straight face. I'm sorry, I tried. I'm sorry, I tried.
I have two comments on that, and I have zero for the podcast.
Okay.
So, essentially, yeah, a university professor from Tokai University, a stats guy, basically looked at. No, and I can't speak for his research because I haven't seen it, and I'm still waiting to hear from this guy about what things he considered and what he didn't consider, so I don't really know the value of it. But I assume he knows what he is deep into sabermetrics, and I'll assume he knows what he's talking about. So giving him the benefit of the doubt, he basically did an analysis. His analysis showed that Darvish would win between 12 and 16 games. Now, being familiar with statistical analysis, I was telling John, probably the result of his different equations and linear regression, multiple regressions, was that he was a 90% chance that he would win between 12 and 16 games, which is how these things are generally calculated. You can't really predict outliers. So, and that his true ability in the majors would fall somewhere between in that range. So, I'm inclined to believe his analysis. I'm skeptical only in the sense that I can't see what went into it. And I don't know how he's basing it, or what he's considering and what he's not considering. So,
right.
But I consider it a very reasonable projection. Now, is it possible? One problem is that Darvish is making an adjustment here that a lot of people aren't. It can't just be the numbers from Japan to the U.S. It's got to be that's where you have to start. You have to basically live and die with the translation from Japan to the U.S. And because everybody who's doing it makes an adjustment as well.
All right. Well, I want to give the listeners four names and ask them who they think had the most wins in their first season in the majors. Okay. First, Hideo Nomo. Second, Kazuhisa Ishii. Third, Daisuke Matsuzaka. And fourth, Hisanori Takahashi. So of those four listeners, who do you think had the most wins in his first year in the majors?
Do we give him the answer?
Yeah, I guess we're going to give him the answer. It was Daisuke Matsuzaka.
Yeah.
And he had 15. And next was Ishii with 14, and then Nomo with 13, and then Takahashi with 10. So anything's possible, folks.
Yeah.
If Ishii can get 14 wins in his first year, I mean, and he's maybe half the pitcher Darvish is. It's hard to project.
I think he's more than half the pitcher Darvish is, but the point is all the value in being Darvish is being 20% better than Ishii.
Yeah. Well, I mean, firstly, with the Texas Rangers, the team that Darvish is going to, and all the categories that the Mariners were in last place, they were up near the top or in first place. This offensive team, the park is an offensive park. Does that guarantee him wins? No.
No, it's irrelevant.
No, but do they get a lot of runs? Yes. Are they going to make pretty good outs? Yeah. Is there a chance for him to win a lot of games? Yeah.
They might not have, you've said that they don't have a great defense, but, they won a championship with that defense, and it is very, in broad abstract terms, it's very hard to win a championship with a really bad defense.
Yeah, I picked on their defense, and then I did a little bit more homework. And
I think it's pretty ordinary. It's probably better than average.
It's probably better than average, yeah, it is. It's just maybe some particular positions are not great, but I mean, every team has that. So I picked on them, and I did some research, and they're better than I thought, so... We'll see how it goes. I project for him, since I think that he is going to get the run support, and I think he's going to pitch fairly well. I think he's going to make 25 starts at least, and I think he can win 15 of those.
I think he can too. I think he's going to. I don't know. I don't know. And of course, John saw the John saw the title of this article, and he went, and he did. Now, see, what happens is we came into this article with different viewpoints. I saw it on the net, and I saw sabermetric analysis. It evaluates Darvish's chances as perhaps winning 16 games, and that, you know, the light went on, and I went, okay, this looks interesting. John thought Darvish could win 16 games. Now, this sounds so much like the hokum you hear around Japanese baseball teams. Oh, he's a 14-game winner. He's going to win 16 games. You know, how many games are you going to win? Nobody really knows because there's so the pitcher's contribution to individual wins is so small, to be honest, and it's hard to have for an individual to amass so much value on his own that he can guarantee 15 wins, that he can be expected to win 15 games, that for somebody to project, oh, he should win 16 is just foolish. I mean,
yeah.
But they do it all the time here. They do it. It's the next to saying this is counting people's home batting practice home runs in camp. This has got to be one of the dumbest things they do in Japanese baseball is say, this pitcher is going to win 14 games. Was that a rant? Okay.
And Dennis, as for the second part of your question, who's going to be the next guy to step up? I think obviously Monkun, Masahiro Tanaka with the Eagles is the guy up, and I don't think you're talking about that guy because everybody knows about him. I think you're looking for the guy after him. And my suggestion would be Hirokazu Sawamura of the Giants. I think he's got the stuff.
Right.
He's got the speed. Right. He's got the poise. Definitely has the poise.
Right.
And he's got the makeup. And, he already had a successful, I think I talked about it on the podcast last year that his record was not over 500 with the Giants for a long part of the season, most of the season. I don't think he got it to 11-11 until.
But it was a very good record.
He had good outings. He was very steady.
He had bad bullpen support. He had bad run support at times. He had a couple of things cost him more than they should have cost him.
Exactly. So I think he's that next guy. I mean, he might not be great, but some of the guys who have gone over there haven't been great. So I think he's the next guy. He certainly has the star potential here.
Well, he was considered a major league caliber prospect when he was here, and that was the. You know, usually for these guys who don't want, who have picked their team and they're not going to play for another team, they need an out. You know, if I'm not picked by the Daiei Hawks or, you know, the Nankai Hawks or the Nankai Great Ring or whoever, I'm going to, play for Xerox or I'm going to play for the Nomo Baseball Club or in Salamura's case, I'm going to go sign with a major league team.
Right. So is he your guy?
I would have to say so. I think, of course, Sugiuchi had. Well, of course, we're not talking about big guys now, but I think Kenta Maeda has a good chance.
Yeah, he's still only 23. Yeah, yeah.
He's got a chance to develop. He's not going to have. His velocity is probably peaking right now, and he's a clever kid, and he's a gutsy little guy. Little, he's not that little, but you know he's a gutsy guy. He has a chance.
Gutsy young guy.
Yeah, he has a chance to put some muscle on his frame and be a bit of a bulldog. Maybe develop another pitch. He could probably pitch in the majors when he's ready. And he says he'll be young when he gets to the majors too. He'll probably be a 27-year-old free agent. So
yeah.
Was that a rant? Okay.
Yeah, let's get on to the next question.
Okay.
And here it is from Mike in Tokorozawa.
Hi, Jim and John. This is Mike in Saitama, the number one Lions fan.
Hi.
And Kai, number one A Lions fan. We're getting ready for a baseball practice today, sitting in a noisy coffee shop. Apologize for that. Just a question about the draft. I know recently Jim had talked about on the show that he didn't like the draft, the configuration of it, the way it's set up in Japan, or the draft in general. I do like the draft. I think it does help the small market teams compete with the larger ones. However, the Sugano case really does show the flaws in the Japanese configuration of the draft. Why don't they build in something like the NHL has? The NHL has a system where teams retain control of a player for 2 years after being selected. They are drafted at the age of 18, and the team retains control of the player until they are 20. If they aren't signed by then they can go back into the draft and go to another team, but generally, that seems to work. I think a two-year gap after being drafted is quite a long time for a player to sit out. Most players, like Sugano and others, probably wouldn't want to stall their careers for that period of time. 1 year is long enough, I would imagine. So why doesn't the Japanese system build that kind of caveat into its configuration? That would preclude players from Sugano and Chono and others from rejecting the teams that pick them, I think. Anyway, I look forward to your responses in the show this week.
All right, so the draft, I think actually before I was the one who said I didn't like or dislike the draft immensely, or what? Did you say that too?
I wish they'd take the draft and blow it up.
Okay, well then with both of us, because I really not put a new draft,
but just get rid of the whole darn thing.
Yeah, I just said, hey, what they do now is it should be called the player acquisition meeting and dinner with drinks and
the piano bar.
And I said. And I mean, now I'm not sure. You said that, yes, you agreed with Mike that the system does help weaker teams, but I kind of disagree in the aspect that, yeah, if you're a glamour team and you have a lot of money and you can pay some guys, some players before you actually, you know, get to the draft, because that's basically how it's done. It's a song and dance where all the guys have already talked to the teams and they know who's going to draft them. And, essentially, I mean, sometimes we get what we get. We get this Sugano situation every year where two teams decide they're going to pick one guy, or three teams or four teams. But essentially, you know, you go through this song and dance, and then you walk up there and, you know, pick the guy you want and then walk back. And then he's already talked to you. He knows you're going to pick him, and they're ready to go. I mean, it's not a draft where, look, we're going to select you and you're going to come here and that's the end of it. It's more like a song and dance to me.
Well, I think you answer the question, does it help competitive balance? And the answer is, sure it does, because the alternative is, now, it depends on what your baseline is. If your baseline is no draft, then the Japanese draft does help competitive balance. Before the draft, there were essentially, in Japanese baseball since 1950, we'll start with 1950, there were essentially four dynasties. They were the Giants, there were the Nankai Hawks, the Nishitetsu Lions, and the Hankyu Braves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, since the early 70s, so that was a period of 25 years. The draft started in, I'm going to say, 1965, and by the late 70s, very few players had not gone through the draft, or at least had a chance to be drafted. Almost the rosters are filled with draft talent. At that point, the dynasties are the Carpenta Minor Dynasty. The Giants really didn't have a dynasty. Essentially, the Carp, the Seibu Lions, and the Fukuoka Daiei Hawks. That was it.
All right. Well, what I want to see is these weaker teams draft first and at least have the chance to get the best available pitcher or the best available position player who fits their team. Now they're just stuck at going after teams.
So you would say, well, okay, let's get out of the idea. Well, I'll get out of the idea. So you want to see a draft for the purpose of competitive balance.
I want to, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Now that's something which I'm not numb to the idea that that's what the draft is for, but really, essentially, the draft exists to deprive players of their bargaining rights as outside the system is. And it's same in the U.S. It started in the U.S., had nothing to do with competitive balance. It has nothing to do with competitive balance in Japan. It's all about depriving amateur players of their right to work where they want and for whom they want and for how much they want.
Now, what about Mike's question about the 2 year thing? I remember you said that there is a 2 year.
Well, there is a 2 year. Now, if you want to play, now Sugano is waiting out 1 year because Sugano is going it the difficult way, which is he is not going to play ball. He's mm-hmm. not going to play in the league. He's not going to play for a team. He's going to go back to his university and work out in the gym.
Okay.
Throw in the bullpen.
But if you were to actually play,
2 years.
And how would he be able to do that?
How would he could go become a corporate leaguer?
He could go and play with corporate league. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Now the famous exception is now, and I don't know how this works, but it used to be that if you played amateur ball in the U.S. or you played some kind of baseball in the U.S., it was a year. And so I believe Daisuke Motoki did this.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Hawaii and played something, did something or other, Tiddlywinks perhaps. And Suguru Egawa in the late 70s, after he was, the second time he was drafted, this time by the Hanshin Tigers, he went to play for the, I think it wasn't the Hanshin Tigers. Anyway, he went to play for the second time he was drafted for a team he didn't want to play for. He went to Alaska and played for the Anchorage Glacier Pilots during
nice.
The summer.
Nice.
And came back, and it was eligible, technically eligible for the draft, and then a whole bunch of other interesting and entertaining things happened.
And these are both guys who ended up with the Giants.
These are both guys who ended up with the Giants.
Okay. So, I mean, if he wants to get around this, if Sagana wants to get around this, and he wants to play, even if he goes overseas, he still has to wait the year, but it might have to be 2 years if he, you don't know.
I don't know exactly. The rules.
Okay, yeah, I'm not familiar with the rules as well, but I would say, yeah, that we need to make these drafts more like drafts. Put the lower seeded teams at the top and let them pick the best athletes available first. Let's do it that way. Sometimes you get a good athlete who fits your team, like maybe you have a need in the outfield, but there's no outfield, the outfielder is not the best available athlete or best available player, so you just draft that best available player even though he doesn't fit in your team. So maybe you already have a rotation, you're looking for an outfielder, but you draft a pitcher anyway.
Sure, because he's so much more valuable than the outfielder.
Right, right. That
happens all the time. Japan, the most valuable amateur prospects are 90%, 75 to 80% of them are pitchers.
Okay.
I mean, okay, let me tell you that I did a study on this when I was doing all that. I was messing around with people's birth months a couple of years ago, and I had to rank players. I had to you can't evaluate players' talent. If a player born in March who's a fourth round pick, you can't expect him to have the same value as a player born in April who's a first round pick.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, one of the things I did find is there's a fairly predictable amount of value. First round draft choices are more valuable than second. Not everyone, of course.
Right.
There's a range of values, and essentially the worst first round draft choice is as bad as the worst sixth round draft choice. But what you get is that the 20 most valuable first round draft choices are many, 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 many more times valuable than the 20 more valuable fourth-round draft choices, and so on down the ladder. There is an extreme, first-round draft choices are very valuable. You can say, now, they don't always pan out. This is true. But they are your best access for talent, regardless. They're the best, the more first round draft choices you can have, and of course in that Japan is limited to one, and then if he doesn't sign you get nothing, which is a problem. The current draft system is a mess because it's ill conceived and ill executed, and it's full of these little silly little rules that don't make any sense.
Okay. All right.
Now the question is, should it be for competitive balance, as you and Mike suggested? Yeah, that's an ideological question. I don't think it's not really a practical question. Should it be? Well, it's entirely subjective.
Okay. Well put. Well put. That pretty much sums up what we were talking about, what I was trying to say about the draft. And yeah, competitive balance I think is important. You say it's not practical, but
I don't think it's not practical. I think it's a desirable if my point is this: if your goal in the draft is to have competitive balance, then you need a different draft. If your goal is to have a free market, then you need a different kind of system. They have a system which is kind of, sort of like a free market in you know, Adam Smith's worst nightmare. But, and it kind of sort of has some kind of element of introducing competitive balance, if your idea of competitive balance is giving one team what it wants 90% of the time.
Right.
So it's really, it's a hybrid of I don't know what, of it's an ill-conceived hybrid. It needs to be, they need to really focus on what the purpose of the draft is instead of this is the system we're stuck with.
Yeah, I hope they iron it out. I don't foresee any changes soon, but we'll, you know, I'll make the suggestions to the reporters along with trying to help them figure out who's going to be the Pacific League this year.
Well, I knew we were going there.
All right, Mike, much appreciated. Thank you very much, Mike and Dennis, for your MP3 questions. They were awesome, very well taped, and they sounded great.
Enjoyed it. Thanks. It does. So please talk to us some more.
Yes, send in your MP3 questions, or you can just hit us up on the Facebook page or send them via email, you know, the 1990s way.
You can send them the snail mail to John.
That's right. You can get an envelope, send it to him at the office. But if you want to email, it's yakyujohn@gmail.com. Jim, thanks a lot, buddy. You did a great job tonight.
And good night. Thank you all for listening.
From the lovely studios here at Shaka G. Colton. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your winter camp.
Uh-oh.
Good night.
Bye.